Word of mouth.
Heaven. I'm in heaven.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. All movie genres go in and out of fashion, the Western, the rom-com, the biopic, slasher movies. But as historian Richard Barrios notes, the official notice of fini has been hung on musicals at least six times. And again, they managed to rise up singing. But why? Why in the depths of the Depression did 42nd Street triumph? What made Sound of Music and Oliver hits while Americans rioted in the streets? How did Les Miserables become an international phenomenon in the age of Hollywood pyrotechnics and reality TV? Barrios proposes that behind their deceptively simple, glimmering facades, musicals have a place in American culture beyond pure escapism. In his new book, Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter, is full of razzly-dazzly hits, dismal flops, sharp criticism, and enough insider gossip to make the case really interesting. Richard Barrios, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what do you say when people say, ugh, it's a musical, I hate musicals?
Oh, I tell them they're not alone, that this sort of thing happens a lot. Musicals divide people as much as politics do, really.
You spend a lot of time in the book on what makes them work and what does not. So let's just focus on a few. Why don't we look at Singin' in the Rain, and we've got a little music to set the tone.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
Okay, Richard Barrios, what made that musical work?
More than anything else, I think, and there's many great things to choose from in it, but it's a musical where the script matters as much as the songs and the dances. It's an incredibly witty script, and it is a way of sort of paying tribute to all of the movie musicals that came before it, because it starts at the very beginning of the sound era. So it encompasses all of movie musicals, and it does so very wittily and kind of nasty, too, occasionally, which I enjoy.
So how about the ones that didn't work? You can take your pick.
I can go to paint your wagon. That's always a good target to hang to hang bullseyes on. They got a lot of people who could not sing, like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood. They spent way too much money by going to a remote part of Oregon that was prone to flooding. So they chose the location very poorly. And they tried to make it really hip and current. And it was neither of those things. So it was a total misfire of the wrong material, the wrong people, the wrong intentions, the wrong amount of money spent. So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Well, there is a special and precise bond that you write about between musicals and their audience, a mutually admiring kinship, you say, unintelligible to outsiders and quite fragile. When either side violates it, crises occur. What are some of the elements that go into that plot? It isn't always that someone has a great singing voice. It's not always a plausible plot. Some great singers and duds. Give us some of these elements.
It's sort of an intangible. It has to do with understanding how music and words can connect and then how they can be transmitted to an audience for the maximum amount of comprehension and empathy. You get something like Judy Garland, a great singer, singing Over the Rainbow, and it's a situation that people can understand, a girl from Kansas longing for a world of color and magic.
There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
That's an example of where it all comes together because it's all been thought out. And the audience is always part of the equation. And sometimes movies leave out the audience and how they might respond. And that's when a movie musical does not matter, when it forgets about its audience.
Well, you just led me to something that also makes this book so interesting, inside view of how films are produced. Over the Rainbow almost didn't make it into The Wizard of Oz.
At one point, a number of MGM producers wanted to cut it. They said, why should Judy go around singing in the barnyard? Imagine what that would have been like.
Drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the
to this point that it has to matter in order to be successful. Don't all films have to matter to be successful?
Well, with escapism, mattering is sort of a relative concept. It doesn't have to be totally connected with current events, for example, but it has to offer something beneath the surface, I think, some sort of resonance, strike some sort of responsive chord. And that was one of the reasons that so many big musicals like Paint Your Wagon and Hello, Dolly, coming in at the end of the 1960s, seemed so clueless, because there was so much difficult going on in the world. You had Vietnam, you had riots in the United States, and here come these movies with sort of mindless optimism that seemed really willfully offensive, even, because it seemed to totally disregard what was going on. And a musical can maybe make people happy in a difficult situation or an unhappy situation, but it can't be oblivious.
Well, even if My Fair Lady, Hello, Dolly, Camelot in the 1960s were tone deaf, there are movies like 42nd Street, which is a great hit during the Depression. Doesn't a musical have to be out of date somewhat to transport us?
Well, 42nd Street was as timely as a film could be, because it came in right as President Roosevelt was being inaugurated, and Warner Brothers promoted it with Roosevelt's own slogan, New Deal. They promoted it as a New Deal in entertainment. And it gave Depression-weary audiences hope, because here's this totally unknown girl, Ruby Keeler, who becomes a star. And it said, well, if this nobody can make it big, maybe you can get out of the Depression too.
Hmm.
I got it! Well, what is it? A penny?
A nickel?
Will you hold your horses and let me get the dirt off?
A dime! We're in the money! We're in the money!
And following the 60s, of course, the 1970s, a time of still continuing struggle in the U.S., not a great age for the movie musical. But you single out one, Cabaret, what, 72, 74? I can't recall.
72.
Why did it work?
Well, for one thing, it paid attention to the world around it. It connected a lot of the unrest going on in the entire world by that time, from the 60s and early 70s, with the rise of Nazi Germany. And it did so in a very sort of hard-edged, unsentimental way. There weren't nuns defeating these Nazis or anything like that. It seemed relevant. And with Bob Fosse in charge, it was very hard-edged. The editing was much sharper than most films had tried to be musically before then. So it really connected with audiences. But then after that, musicals just sort of faded away. You had things like MAME and Lost Horizon, which seemed totally clueless. And something like that's going to alienate a large part of the population, and that's what happened.
MAME with Lucille Ball, a hit on television. What was it? The New York Times columnist Pauline Kael said about her.
Did she do her own singing, or was she dubbed by Dick Cavett?
While you can ponder that question, we'll listen to a little bit from Maybe This Time. This is Liza Minnelli's pretty transcendent performance in Cabaret.
Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady Peaceful, Lady Happy, that's what I long to be. Well, all the odds are there in my favor. Something's bound to begin. It's gotta happen.
we're talking about this submerged movie genre that keeps resurfacing, the musical. Richard Barrios is with us. He worked in the music and film industry before turning to film history, and his new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. Makes the case that musicals are surprisingly sophisticated bellwethers of American culture, taste, preference, and even politics. I want to stay on that connection to the real world and look at musicals as one of the more integrated refuges in Hollywood for African Americans, for sexuality in the days of the Hays Code, the Motion Picture Production Code, and homosexuality on film. Why, Richard Barrios, do musicals get a pass in those forbidden places?
Well, I think part of it was because entertainment actually had higher profile gay and lesbian people and African Americans participating in them. And so many of the early musicals were backstage theatrical stories. And since these personalities were part of that life, it was sort of easier to bring them along. The very first musical film, as we now consider musicals, was The Broadway Melody, which opened early in 1929, and it featured very prominently a gay costume designer. Hmm. A few months after that, the early musical On With the Show, which was also a backstage story, featured the wonderful recording and stage performer Ethel Waters introducing the song Am I Blue and totally hitting it out of the ballpark.
I think
so. And this sort of continued on. It waxed and waned. But by the 1940s, you had Ethel Waters again with Lena Horne in the great musical Cabin in the Sky. You had the Nicholas Brothers and Lena Horne in Stormy Weather. And you had very covert but nevertheless detectable to people who understood gay presences in movies like Lady in the Dark and Broadway Rhythm, some of those things.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of that. This is Lena Horne singing Stormy Weather. Let's talk about the medium of film for a moment. Making things matter, as you point out, is not simply adapting a successful Broadway show for film, nor does it work the other way around. What is it specifically about the medium of film that makes it fly or not?
Well, one of the mistakes I think that a lot of live shows are making now that are adapted from movies is that they try to copy movie techniques onto the live stage. And these are two completely different mediums, and they should not be confused with one another. They should not overlap. And I wish they'd stop trying to adapt animated films into live stage shows. It doesn't really work. Lion King was good, and they should have stopped there.
Well, I was going to stop you on that because I would say Lion King did work. But the whole idea of the musical, it is pretty awkward and silly in its own way, right? I mean, I'm thinking
it can be.
Well, I'm thinking of that, you know, in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you have the Scottish father who, you know, when his son, you hear the music start to swell and his son is posing like he's about to sing and he's saying, no, stop the music. There's not going to be any singing.
Exactly. And really, song cues and that sort of thing have been a target since the very beginning of musicals and sound in the late 1920s, even. You see some early musicals make fun of some of those conventions because they are silly. And let's face it, musicals do have to occupy their own particular world with a certain kind of suspension of disbelief.
Well, why do you think we're willing to suspend disbelief for a musical?
I think the best answer to that would come in the way that a really good musical can give the effect of making dreams seem tangible. They sort of tap into our subconscious and provide these brilliant, when they're done well, illustrations of what we dream about and what we think about. And, you know, to make fantasies seem real is quite an achievement. And musicals do it in a very specific way. And it's a way that the tenor of the times isn't always connected with, which is why they go in and out of fashion so much.
Well, we just scraped the surface, Richard Barrios, but I want to thank you so much for your time.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Richard Barrios is a film historian whose new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. There's much more in his book, including some YouTube links to some of the great sequences in musical history. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz I'm gonna...
Today's show is all about music. From the classic movie musical to experimental music played on slinkies, which you'll get to hear later. Somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, we've saved room to listen to some new music. Here to pluck his favorite songs of the month is producer Zach Nugent in a segment we call the Audio Orchard.
Although the weather this spring might lend itself perfectly to rainy day music, this month's playlist is inspired by the sunny days in between, like today. The first song on my playlist is called Completely Not Me by Jenny Lewis.
I could have died that night, way back in June. Saw my soul hang heavy above the room. Slack-jawed, I confess, bit by my hubris. I was spooked out, obsessed by the moon. I was completely not me. But baby, I'm coming clean. The doctor said...
Jenny Lewis is the former front woman of the band Rilo Kiley. Her new solo album is called The Voyager. It's coming out in July. It was produced by many notable musicians, including Ryan Adams and Beck.
Bed, eyes rolled back in my head. I was begging for you to go away. I was completely on me. Baby, I'm coming clean. Completely.
The next song on my playlist is called From Eden by the singer Hozier.
Babe, there's something tragic about you. Something so magic about you. Don't you agree?
Hozier is short for Andrew Hozier Byrne. He's an up-and-coming singer and guitarist from Ireland, raised on Motown, gospel, and Delta blues. Those traditional influences shine through in his songs and balance nicely with his modern pop aesthetic. The next song on the playlist is called Mercury Dime. It's by the band Death Vessel.
Struck too high, my bell bleeds. From the mouth to the die, from the die to the D. Elsie Marlowe, where are you? Show your feathers on the floor of the wavy blue.
Death Vessel is a folk band from Rhode Island. They play the kind of low-key, quiet music you might not expect to hear from a band called Death Vessel. Lead singer Joe Thibodeau says the band name doesn't reference the style of music, but the content. Death Vessel's new album is called Island Intervals, and was recorded in Iceland and references mysterious and sometimes dark Icelandic fairy tales. Death Vessel will be playing at the Thing in the Spring Festival in Peterborough, New Hampshire, on June 7th.
There I go.
The last song in this month's Audio Orchard comes from a band called Bamboos. The song is called Helpless Blues. The Bamboos are a 9-piece Australian soul band. Their latest album is called Fever in the Road. It's the band's 6th album, and it's getting rave reviews. Perfect for that sunny day in an otherwise rainy spring.
As always, you can find Zach's full playlist at wordofmouthradio.org. And what about you? Do you have a new song you cannot stop listening to? We'd love to hear it. Post a link to your favorite new music on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, and help us create a community-sourced playlist. Stick around for Live from Studio D. We'll hear a performance from a New Hampshire-based artist who makes his own instruments out of... well, just about anything. You gotta hear it to believe it. And you can, right after the news, when Word of Mouth continues, from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. David Kontak creates new instruments from just about anything and everything. This piece is being performed by the David Kontak Ensemble, 4 people. It's called Slinky Quartet and is literally played using 4 amplified slinkies. And David Kontak is with us here in the studio. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here.
Great to have you here and all of your whirring, whizzing, squeaking, whistling kind of sounds.
Will your neighbors ever forgive you?
I'm not sure if the newsroom will ever forgive us. So you've got your amplified slinky. Do you mind just pulling it apart? Because
sure.
Slinkies, you know, of any toy is something you think it moves in a kind of random way every single time. So you've got it on... one paddle and one...
Yeah, there's a contact microphone attached to a thin piece of plastic on one side, and that's how it's amplified, because the slinky itself makes very little noise in a room just without it amplified. But it does really create a kind of a crashing sound against its bass. Then the user's movements dictate the sound, so the user can play it very simply or play it wildly. I've been known to play slinkies where I... literally go floor to ceiling and slap it against the floor and the ceiling as I played in a large arc.
And there were 4 of you playing, so are you all trying to play different things or playing in sync with each other?
It's kind of – there's no way to play precisely in sync, like we're going to be really strictly in rhythm. But I think we use volume pedals where we can pull our signal in and out of the mix. And by doing that, I think it allows one person to come to the foreground, then fall back, and another person emerges. And in that way, the pulse kind of moves from person to person.
How do you know when that composition is done? I mean, I was watching you guys and you just all sort of stopped at the same time.
Well, I think that, you know, we've arranged some visual cues and I let them know when, you know, we have a general outline of the piece. You know, the individual notes are improvised in my pieces, but the overall structure has been predetermined. So people, when they get up there, there's a plan. It's not just like, okay, let's just make noise on slinkies. So we move by moving from person to person and doing different combinations, duets and trios, and then we build to a large climax of just apocalyptic slinky noise.
David, why do you make instruments? What started it all?
Well, I mean, I have a background in fine arts. I'm an occupational therapist now, and I work with adaptive technology. But my first career was in visual arts, and I've always been interested in sort of pushing the boundaries of art. I did a lot of printmaking and drawing, and then my work has sort of evolved more into constructions, mobile sculptures, sound sculptures, as well as instruments that make unusual sounds.
So do you think there is a line between music and sound art, or do you consider what you make music?
Music is such a broad term that I don't know if I want to be limited by that, because I certainly don't use music in the very conventional sense, but it is very organized sound. It's certainly not random at all, and it just doesn't use traditional tonalities and rhythms. But I still think it's informed a lot by the history of music. It's not completely separate from that tradition. I think it's also related a little bit to performance art, where it's a visual multimedia experience and not just sound alone.
Mm-hmm. Can you show us one of your instruments? What have you
sure,
got with you?
Sure. Well, what I have here is what I call a babbal, which is basically a very thin piece of wood with a whole lot of different length rods that emerge from it, and it has a contact microphone on the bottom that will amplify anything that I do to mm-hmm. the rods. So I can play the instrument in a variety of ways, with a bow or by plucking it. And it's just a very strange but interesting set of sounds that you get. It sounds sometimes like a pan flute, sometimes like maybe a bowed upright bass.
So let's listen to a recording of the babbal, several of you on different kinds of babbles. This is the David Kontak Ensemble. Well, you were showing me earlier your string thing, mm-hmm. and you were sort of making it move. It's flexible, which mm-hmm. is somewhat different than a lot of the instruments that we've grown up with, you know, the sort of rigid. You work around the instrument on some level, but it's the opposite for you, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally people have changed the pitch on like a violin or an upright bass or something by just they have a very rigid instrument that's very stiff, and then the strings maintain their pitch, and you move your finger along the string to get a varying, you know, higher or lower pitch. In some of the instruments I built, it's really fun to go against that and actually have an instrument that the entire structure is unstable, and that you have to like bend and twist the instrument itself to create sound. And I think that it's the interaction of the human body and movement and the instrument that makes my instruments unique. I don't want there to be a kind of an image of a musician standing very stiffly on stage, moving very little. I want the audience to see that there's a relationship between the performer's movements and then the sound that's coming out of the instrument.
So that must mean that it can be different every time.
I don't think there's even a way to play it the same way every time. Mm-hmm. I think that would be impossible.
Well, let's hear more from the David Kontak Ensemble playing Rotations. Now, David, what's going on in this song?
All of the instruments that you hear here are basically machines. Even though the human, you know, performers are manipulating these machines, the first sound you hear is a long threaded rod in which washers are dropped down the rod and they're just falling in a cascade down the rod. Then the second performer comes in with a piece of plastic that's cut into an interesting shape, and then this performer then plays on that piece of plastic with an electric motor that lights up. And so as you rub that electric motor across that piece of plastic, it creates really interesting different pitches and droning sounds. Then, of course, a third person comes in, and try not to make the music always go very dense, but to try to have people pull in and out to keep a lot of air and clarity into the mix. But then there is a point when we really build it into a very loud section.
Wow, I listen to this and I can imagine like a movie soundtrack. I mean, do you see pictures in your mind when you're playing this music?
You know, I don't know if I so much see pictures in my mind. I think the way I look at these things is I try to set up a set of an instrument that has a set of physical demands to it, and then a performer interfaces with that by moving or gesturing in a certain way, and the thing that is in between those ends up being the music. The interaction between an instrument that has specific needs and a performer who has specific motions creates an outcome. And it's not random at all, but it's not something that's repeatable or predictable.
Well, don't adjust your radio back at home. That is the David Kontak Ensemble. What a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me very much.
David Kontak, musician, inventor of instruments, and leader of the David Kontak Ensemble. Also in the ensemble is Eric Gagne, Ben Rogers, and Dave Seidel. They will be performing at the Thing in the Spring Festival in Peterborough tomorrow. You can see a video of the David Kontak Ensemble performing live in Studio D and learn more about the other bands at the Thing in the Spring at wordofmouthradio.org. In order to make it in the music business, artists need to offer their material on a variety of platforms, from CDs to iTunes to Spotify. Now we're going to hear about a band which created a song with a sole purpose in mind, to save it from extinction. Here's Sean Hurley with the story.
There was something coming in the mail. The rarest, most endangered thing to ever arrive in our mailbox. Here it is. A slim cardboard box. Inside it, a 7-inch vinyl record. On the record, the most endangered song in the world.
On Earth Day, 400 people received a rare record with one song on it, titled Sir Martin Tiger. The record is one of only 400 and will degrade after a certain amount of plays. There are no digital copies of the song in existence. The endangered song. The first song made to go extinct unless it's reproduced.
I battled open the tiny cardboard box and set the clear plastic record on my turntable. I sat back in the warm cookie crackle of diamond on vinyl. So this isn't just a song etched into a rotten kind of plastic that fails as fast as possible. It's part of the Smithsonian Zoo's awareness campaign for the critically endangered Sumatran tiger. Only about 400 tigers are left alive in the wild today, thus 400 records. The idea is that the 400 influencers who received a copy of the endangered song will be responsible for saving it by uploading the digital copy they make to YouTube or SoundCloud, or really anywhere on the internet. Save the song, save the tiger, is the somewhat strained analogy. The layered gimmick here, if I can call it that, is that the Smithsonian National Zoo wants to raise awareness on two fronts. First, save the tiger. Second, to reinvent the public's idea of what the Smithsonian is. Their cobwebbed image as a museum that could itself be inside a museum needed an overhaul. So says a recent study commissioned by the Smithsonian Zoo's head of communications, Pamela Baker-Masson.
And what the data showed was that people think the Smithsonian Institution is a dusty place that collects objects. But very few people realize that what we do here is a tremendous amount of academic work, research in the case of the zoo and the Conservation Biology Institute. It's all about conservation.
While probably best known for successfully breeding the giant panda in captivity, the zoo also has many smaller victories.
And we even have animals that we've reintroduced to the wild. And the black-footed ferret is a perfect example of that in North America.
But success with the black-footed ferret couldn't help them with the endangered tiger and the bad image problem. And right from the start, Baker-Masson says the zoo was faced with a huge obstacle. They wanted a national awareness campaign, but they didn't have any money to pay for it. But then, they got lucky.
Well, we were introduced to DDB, and they agreed to provide the creative services to develop a national campaign for us, all pro bono.
DDB is the New York ad agency responsible for the iconic Think Small campaign for the VW bug in the 1960s. They're also said to be the inspiration for a particular show about men who are mad.
DDB is often mentioned in Mad Men, and you know, DDB as a company is largely credited with starting the creative revolution in the 60s. We're still on Madison Avenue and still in the same office we were back then.
That's Matt Eastwood, Chief Creative Director at DDB.
It's the Don Draper role, which essentially means that I oversee all of the creative output from the company.
While it's hard to imagine Don Draper uttering the words pro bono, Eastwood says DDB has always done a certain amount of work for free.
It sort of comes from the founder of our company. So a guy called Bill Birnbach founded the company, and he had a belief that creativity can change the world for the better. And that's sort of built into our annual performance reviews, in that we are required to deliver some projects that help make the world a better place using creative excellence.
Eastwood was instantly on board when he heard about the endangered Sumatran tiger / Smithsonian Image Project. He picked a team of writers, artistic directors, and designers, and set them to work.
We got to the idea quicker than we got to making the idea. It took a long time to pull together. It was very hard to, first of all, to get a band to sign up to release their song, not digitally, only on, you know, in analog form, which is pretty unusual.
Portugal the Man is an alt-rock band whose two founding members, John Gourley and Zach Carruthers, grew up together in Alaska, and who spend a small part of their time wishing they'd named their band differently. One of their songs can be heard on an episode of The Walking Dead, and another beds a Taco Bell commercial.
That's one reason.
Portugal the Man don't have huge hits, but they do well on the alternative charts. They're also known for their charity work. Co-founder Zach Carruthers plays bass and sings backup.
A lot of things with charities can be very sketchy, you know. Sometimes you don't know where all the money's going. And I thought that this one was a very cool way to raise awareness.
Carruthers says the response to the band's involvement in the project has been largely positive. But there have been some critics, including one unconvinced tiger advocate with whom Carruthers corresponded at length.
And he's a big activist about wild cats. And basically at the end, I was just like, I guess all I can say is how many people were talking about the Sumatran tiger on the internet last week versus this week. There's a lot more this week. And that's all we were trying to, that was our main goal.
Pamela Baker Masson says the Smithsonian has been tracking the numbers of people talking about the project.
Instantly, within 48 hours, by our count, we reached probably 3.5 million people just through social media.
But can an internet-based song-saving campaign translate into saving real tigers in Indonesia? Zach Carruthers thinks so.
You know, they're a protected animal in Indonesia, and so it just makes everybody way more accountable and puts the eyes on them. You just need a lot of set of eyes on people to make sure they're doing the right thing.
Matt Eastwood agrees, but sees this as a simple first step in the right direction.
Well, I think what we're trying to do is set a foundation of knowledge, and I think people can't care about a problem if they don't know about the problem. And so I think awareness in this case is hugely important. And then, you know, it's the beginning of a much longer journey, I think. This in itself is not going to save the Sumatran tiger, but it's a start.
Have you ever wondered what would happen if a zoo and an ad agency and a band came together to make a record to save a tiger? You can watch it all unfold on YouTube and SoundCloud, where dozens and dozens of copies have been uploaded and shared. Even if the endangered song was never really in any danger, there's no denying that it was saved. Whether that internet rescue will have any impact on a near-extinct species in Indonesia is another matter. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
If you'd like to hear the world's most endangered song, you'll find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You have Red Sox versus Yankees in baseball, Facebook versus Google in the tech world. But when it comes to the best music rivalries, you have to go back a ways. Neil Young versus Lynyrd Skynyrd, Tupac against Biggie, Oasis or Blur?
You don't like not being feted as the greatest living songwriter in England. You can't stand that. And, of course, he wasn't at the time and I was. And he wanted a bit of the action. And you know what annoys me the most about it all? It's Blur and Oasis. Why did their name get put first? It's f***ing Oasis and Blur. F***ing sake. Hats off to him for that.
Oasis's lead singer Noel Gallagher there talking about Blur lead singer Damon Albarn. The British tabloids took the bait, proclaiming Blur versus Oasis, the battle of Britpop, and fans were more than willing to play along. The music world has not had one of those petty, bitter, record-selling public dust-ups for a while. Our guest Stephen Hayden, staff writer at Grantland.com, asked why in his article, Whatever Happened to Music Rivalries? Stephen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you were quite willing to take sides in the Blur versus Oasis battle, which really mattered in Britain. So give us a little backstory about why you pick sides.
The way that rivalry began was that Oasis and Blur released singles on the same day in England. So it was really this sort of battle of capitalism in the British music scene, but that didn't occur here in the United States. So like if you were an American music fan like I was in the mid-90s, 16, 17 years old, and you really had to invent significance in your own mind, and I was more than willing to do that.
So what did being on the Oasis side of this rivalry entail for you?
They were coming out of grunge, you know, like where you had a lot of bands that were very ambivalent about being rock stars. You had this band Oasis that where the first song on their first record is called Rock and Roll Star, you know, and it's about wanting to be famous and wanting to be rich. I'm a rock and roll star. It was a very working class perspective, you know, because they were coming from nothing. And I think that's what they represented to me, that they were this sort of like, you know, people's band. And if you liked Oasis for that reason, it was really easy to look at Blur as sort of the antithesis of that. You know, like if this were like Animal House, Oasis was like John Belushi, and like Blur were like, you know, like the snooty like fraternity, you know. So you're gonna cheer for the slobs, not the snobs, or at least that's where I came at it from.
And it was pretty hard to shake for you, apparently. Why do you think it stayed with you so long after spiky gelled male hair and the Caesar haircut went out of style?
You know, it's funny. I think this is true for a lot of people, where those opinions about music that you form when you're in high school, they tend to stick with you in ways that you maybe don't even realize when you get older. I mean, I think people tend to still be kind of tribal in a way about like the kinds of music that they like or the bands that they liked. And yeah, you know, what I wrote about in that column was the fact that like for the last 20 years, like I never listened to an entire Blur record. I never listened to any of Damon Albarn's other bands. I just held on to this hate of this guy, like, and it was, and I acknowledge that it's stupid, you know, and I was the wrong one, but like, I don't know, it was like I had such a loyalty to Oasis that I could not bring myself to even listen to anything associated with Blur.
You really showed him.
Exactly.
Well, we're past that now. Today, however, you say that music rivalries like between Blur and Oasis just don't exist anymore. Why not, do you think?
It's not so much that, I mean, because obviously there are still instances where pop stars are arguing with each other and there's beefs and all that. But the difference now is that, you know, in the age of social media, it's so much easier to start a fight with somebody and then to also end a fight mm-hmm. with somebody. I mean, all you have to do is send out, you know, 140 characters, you know, mildly disparaging someone, and the internet will take that and run with it. I think that you need a certain amount of space to let like the dislike be truly marinated, you know, to truly marinate in that dislike between two people, you know. And I don't know if we have that anymore. I think things just get blown out of proportion so quickly, you know, the fuel kind of burns really fast and then it's gone.
So take us through some of the great pre-internet age musical death matches.
Well, I think probably the greatest one ever is Beatles versus Stones. In a way, I feel like that's like the blueprint for every other feud that's happened since, because in that case, you had a really obvious kind of black and white option. You had like the good guys and you had like the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And some people liked the bad guys because they thought the good guys were too goody-goody, you know, and that kind of dichotomy exists in a lot of other rivalries. You mentioned Biggie and Tupac
mm-hmm.
being a huge one. And in that case, you had East Coast hip hop versus West Coast hip hop, you know, the originators of rap and like the upstarts.
Who shot ya? Separate the weak from the ops. Leap hard to creep them Brooklyn streets. Your heartbeat sound like Sasquatch feet. Thundering, shaking the concrete. Shot saw me in the drop, 3 1/4. Slaughter, electrical tape around the daughter. Old school, new school, need to learn though. I burn, baby, burn like disco inferno. Burn slow like.
You mentioned Neil Young and Lynyrd Skynyrd mm-hmm. before, and I think that's a great rivalry because, I mean, you still see evidence of that today, like the song Sweet Home Alabama name checks Neil Young, because Neil Young wrote a song called Alabama, which
kind not of, entirely complimentary.
Alabama, you got the weight on your shoulders that's breaking your back.
That leads to the question, were these kind of things trumped up to sell more records?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some degree that's certainly the case. But what makes these rivalries important is what they signify to fans. I think like one really significant rivalry of this century is Toby Keith and the Dixie Chicks. After 9/11, Toby Keith wrote a song called The Angry American.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was going to put his boot up the butt of Osama bin Laden.
Because we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list.
Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks made fun of the song and disparaged Toby Keith. But, I mean, I think that is a clear instance of, like, a musical rivalry having larger cultural significance, that, in a way, you could look at just that rivalry and use it as a case study in like how the country was divided mm-hmm. after 9/11, mm-hmm. you know, like how we were united initially and then, you know, what the political divisions were among people with different points of view.
Well, Stephen, do you miss the rivalry? I mean, good for fans, good for the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good for the industry. Obviously, there's nothing like a fight to get people interested in things. But again, you know, I like to think of pop music as a way that like culture works out their feelings about the world and how we determine what's important. And I think that these rivalries are like the battlegrounds that we use to do that. That
really not sports, not...
Well, sports too. I mean, I'm not saying just pop music, but I think that pop music at its best and at its most significant does do that for the culture. And I think if you lose that, then pop music to me seems a little less vital.
Well, Stephen Hayden, thank you for your time. I guess we can't all just get along.
and thank goodness we can't.
Stephen Hayden, staff writer at Grantland.com. He wrote the article, Whatever Happened to Music Rivalries? You'll find a link to the article on wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know which are your favorite music rivalries. Let us know. We're at wordofmouthradio.org and on facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way.
Thank you for spending a little bit of your weekend with us on Word of Mouth. If you like what you heard, there is much more to hear and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. And a reminder that we would love to hear what's on your playlist. Do you have a new song that you can't stop listening to? Post a link to your favorite new music on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them Monday at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
And all the roads we have to walk are winding. And all the lives.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Cosmate.